Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, journalist and prophet Chris Hedges is back with a new hard-hitting speech. I hope you'll stay tuned. Over the past decade or so, Chris Hedges has emerged as one of the most powerful, most active voices on the American left. He is the author of now 16 books. I have read 5 of his books. I especially like and recommend Death of the Liberal Class from 2010 and Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt from 2012. He published his latest book in late 2018. It is titled America, the Farewell Tour, and his talk this week bears the same name. Like his fellow left progressives, Michael Parenti and Richard Wolff, Hedges traces the sad state of America today back to a historical event that happened around 1970. The big business interests in the United States got together and decided that the country had developed too much actual democracy. The lower classes were getting too prosperous and too powerful. Corporate profits were lower than the moguls wanted. Too much was going to the workers and not enough to the stockholders. The fat cats decided to organize and fight back, to increase their control of all branches of government, to increase their control over all other institutions of public life, universities, regulatory agencies, the mass media, both political parties, you name it. And they did. For them, it was money and effort well invested. And, as Hedges has said on several occasions, they won. They pulled off a corporate coup d'etat. We are now living in the aftermath, and the living is not easy. The corporate interests now completely control all 3 branches of government, both political parties, and almost all public institutions. What to do? For Hedges, first we have to understand what happened. Then we have to fight back appropriately. And the only plausible way of fighting back successfully is through concerted, nonviolent resistance. Like the Yellow Vests in France, but without any of their occasional violence. These are familiar themes with Hedges, and we'll hear variations on these themes again today. But if the themes are familiar, many of the examples and connections are new and interesting. For instance, today Hedges begins by discussing the sociologist Emil Durkheim. Durkheim's observations 1 century ago predicted and explain pretty nicely America today. Hedges spoke in New York City on December 9, 2018. Here is Chris Hedges.
The French sociologist Emil Durkheim, in his book On Suicide, examined the disintegration of social bonds that drive individuals and societies to personal and collective acts of self-destruction. He found that when social bonds are strong, individuals achieve a healthy balance between individual initiative, self-actualization, and communal solidarity, which he called a life-sustaining equilibrium. These individuals and communities, he found, have the lowest rates of suicide. The individuals and societies most susceptible to self-destruction, he wrote, are those for whom these social bonds, this equilibrium, have been shattered. Societies are held together by a web of social bonds that give individuals a sense of being part of a collective and engaged in a project larger than the self. This collective expresses itself through meaningful work, democratic participation, worship, and values, and even patriotism and shared national beliefs. The bonds provide meaning, a sense of purpose, status, and dignity. They offer psychological protection from impending mortality and meaninglessness that comes with being isolated and rejected. The disintegration of these bonds plunges individuals into deep psychological distress that leads ultimately to acts of self-annihilation. Durkheim called this state of hopelessness and despair anomy, which he defined as rulelessness. Rulelessness means the norms that govern a society and create a sense of organic solidarity no longer function. The belief, for example, that if we work hard, obey the law, and get a good education, we can achieve stable employment, social status, and mobility, along with financial security, is no longer true. The old rules that were imperfect and often excluded poor people of color, nevertheless were not a complete fiction in the United States. They offered some Americans, especially those from the white working and middle class, modest social and economic advancement. But the capture of political and economic power by corporate elites, along with the redirecting of all institutions toward the further consolidation of their power and wealth, has broken the social bonds that held the American society together. This rupture has unleashed a widespread malaise and self-destructiveness Durkheim would have recognized. When society is strongly integrated, he wrote, it keeps individuals in a state of dependency, holding them to be in its service and consequently not permitting them to dispose of themselves as they wish. Society is thus opposed to them escaping from their obligations towards it through death. The bond that attaches them to their common purpose attaches them to life, and in any case, the high goal towards which their gaze is turned alleviates the suffering that they feel from life's troubles. Finally, in a coherent and vital community, there is a continual exchange of ideas and feelings from all to each and from each to all, which is like mutual moral support, so that the individual, instead of being reduced to his or her resources only, participates in the collective energy and draws on it when his or hers is exhausted. Our corporate coup d'etat and our failed democracy has freed the oligarchs from all legal and moral constraints. The state of disorganization or anomy is thus reinforced by the fact that passions are less disciplined at a time when they need stronger discipline, Durkheim noted, of the avarice of the rich. It is not for nothing that so many religions have celebrated the benefits and the moral value of poverty, Durkheim wrote. This is because of all schools. It is the one that best teaches humankind to restrain itself. By obliging us to exercise constant discipline over ourselves, it prepares us to accept collective discipline with docility, while wealth, by exalting the individual, constantly risks awakening the spirit of rebellion that is the very font of immortality. Professor Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page, in their study of legislative laws, wrote, the central point that emerges from our research is that the economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while mass based interest groups, and average citizens have little or no independent influence. In essence, the electoral process is a facade, one where we choose between the friendly and inclusive form of corporate fascism under the Democratic Party or the raw, racist, Christian fascism of Donald Trump's white man's party. The economic structures, like the political structures, have been reconfigured to keep the working class in a state of constant distress. American productivity, as the New York Times pointed out, has increased 77% since 1973, but hourly pay has grown by only 12%. If the federal minimum wage was attached to productivity, it would be more than $20 an hour, not $7.25 an hour. Some 41.7 million workers, a third of the U.S. workforce, earn less than $12 an hour. And most of them do not have access to employer-sponsored health insurance. A decade after the 2008 financial meltdown, the Times noted, the average middle-class family's net worth is more than $40,000 below what it was in 2007, and the net worth of black families has declined by 40%, and for Latino families, this figure has dropped by 46%. The financial crisis of 2008 saw the world's central banks, including the Federal Reserve, inject trillions of dollars of fabricated money into the global financial system. The Federal Reserve, which is supposed to regulate banks alone, handed over an estimated $29 trillion of fabricated money to American banks, according to researchers at the University of Missouri. $29 trillion. Kevin Sees and Margaret Flowers from Popular Resistance wrote, one-sixth of this could provide a $12,000 annual basic income, which would cost $3.8 trillion annually, doubling Social Security payments to $22,000 annually would cost $662 billion. And a $10,000 bonus for all U.S. public school teachers would cost $11 billion. Free college for all high school graduates would cost $318 billion, and universal preschool would cost $38 billion. National improved Medicare for all would actually save the nation trillions of dollars over a decade. The Fed and other central banks cut interest rates to near zero, and some central banks in Europe instituted negative interest rates, meaning they would pay borrowers to take loans. The Fed, in a clever bit of accounting, even permitted distressed banks to use these no-interest loans to buy U.S. Treasury bonds. The banks gave the bonds back to the Fed and received 0.25% interest from the Fed. In short, the banks were loaned money at virtually no interest by the Fed and then were paid interest by the Fed on the money they borrowed. The Fed also bought up worthless derivatives and other toxic assets from the banks. And since federal authorities could fabricate as much money as they wanted, it did not matter if what they were buying was worthless. This fabricated money has created a worldwide debt of $325 trillion, more than three times global GDP. The fabricated money was hoarded by banks and corporations, loaned by banks at predatory interest rates, used to service interest on often unsustainable debt, or spent buying back stock, providing billions in compensation for the ruling elites. The fabricated money was not provided to the victims of financial fraud, but the victimizers. It was not invested in the real economy. Products were not manufactured and sold. Workers were not reinstated into the middle class with sustainable incomes, benefits, and pensions. Infrastructure projects were not undertaken. The fabricated money reinflated massive financial bubbles built on debt and papered over a fatally diseased financial system destined for collapse. The criminal irresponsibility of these elites was simply perpetrated again on an even more massive scale. What will trigger the next crash? The $13.2 trillion in unsustainable U.S. household debt? The $1.5 trillion in student debt? The billions Wall Street has invested in the fracking industry that has spent $280 billion more than it generates from its profits? Who knows? What is certain is that a global financial crash, one that may dwarf the meltdown of 2008, is inevitable. And this time, with interest rates near zero, the elites have no plan B. The financial structure will disintegrate. The global economy will go into a death spiral. The rage of a betrayed and impoverished population will, I fear, further empower right-wing demagogues who promise vengeance on the global elites, moral renewal, and a nativist revival, heralding a return to a mythical time when immigrants, women, and people of color knew their place, and in the United States, a Christianized fascism. Given the staggering amount of fabricated money that has to be repaid, the banks need to build greater and greater pools of debt. This is why when you are late in paying your credit card, the interest rate jumps to 28%. This is why if you declare bankruptcy, you are still responsible for paying off your student loan, even as 1 million people a year default on student loans, with 40% of all borrowers expected to default on student loans by 2023. This all comes from the New York Times, by the way. This is why wages are stagnant or have declined, while costs from healthcare and pharmaceutical products to bank fees and basic utilities are skyrocketing. This is why the federal government, further stripped of $1.5 trillion over the next decade by the Trump tax cuts, will soon pay more in interest on its debt than it spends on the military, Medicaid, or children's programs combined. Within a decade, more than $900 billion in interest payments will be due annually. Interest on debt is now the fastest growing major government expense. The cost of interest will hit $390 billion next year, and that's nearly a 50% increase from 2017, according to the Congressional Budget Office. The global financial system is a ticking time bomb. The question is not if it will explode, but when it will explode. And once it does, the inability of the global speculators to use fabricated money with zero interest to paper over the debacle will trigger massive unemployment, high prices for imports and basic services, and very probably a devaluation of the dollar when it is abandoned as the world's reserve currency. No one knows when this will happen, although the historian Alfred McCoy says the American empire, as we know it, will no longer exist by 2030. This manufactured financial tsunami will transform the United States, already a failed democracy, into an authoritarian police state, awash in weapons and driven by hate. Life will become very cheap, especially for the vulnerable, undocumented workers, Muslims, poor people of color, girls and women, anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist critics who will be branded as agents of a foreign power. All will be demonized and persecuted for the collapse. The ruling elites, in a desperate bid to cling to their unchecked power and obscene wealth will sanction indiscriminate violence against any group or individual they fear could instigate a revolt. Empires in decay, ravaged by widespread enemy, embrace an almost willful suicide. Blinded by their hubris and unable to face the reality of their diminishing power, they retreat into a fantasy world where hard and unpleasant facts no longer intrude. They replace diplomacy, multilateralism, participatory politics with a constant mobilization against enemies, real or invented. This self-delusion of late empire saw the United States make the greatest strategic blunder in its history, one that sounded the death knell of the American empire, the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. The architects of the war in the George W. Bush White House and the array of useful idiots in the press and academia who were cheerleaders for it knew very little about the countries being invaded, were stunningly naive about the effects of industrial warfare, and were blindsided by the ferocious blowback. They stated and probably believed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, although they had no valid evidence to support this claim. They insisted that democracy would be implanted in Baghdad and spread across the Middle East. They assured the public that U.S. troops would be greeted by grateful Iraqis and Afghans as liberators. They promised that the oil revenues would cover the cost of reconstruction. They insisted that the bold and quick military strike, shock and awe, would restore American hegemony in the region and dominance in the world. It did the opposite. Historians of empire call these military fiascos a feature of all late empires. Micromilitarism. The Athenians engaged in micromilitarism when during the Peloponnesian War they invaded Sicily, suffering the loss of 200 ships and thousands of soldiers and triggering revolts throughout the empire. Britain engaged in 1956 in micromilitarism when it attacked Egypt in a dispute over the nationalization of the Suez Canal and then quickly withdrew in humiliation, empowering a string of Arab nationalist leaders such as Egypt's Gamal Abdel Nasser and dooming British rule over the nation's few remaining colonies. Neither of these empires recovered. Empires, because they rely on the power to dominate and exploit other countries, are in fact very fragile. Once this ability to dominate is gone, they unravel swiftly. A year for Portugal, 2 years for the Soviet Union, 8 years for France, 11 years for the Ottoman Empire, 17 for Great Britain, and in all likelihood, 27 years for the United States, counting from the crucial year 2003 when we invaded Iraq. Empires are hollowed out from the inside. Their cities fall into decay. And I just come from the New York subway system. 22-minute wait in Penn Station for the next subway. The decline sees the brutality abroad matched by a growing brutality at home. Militarized police gunned down, mostly unarmed, poor people of color, and fill a system of penitentiaries and jails that hold a staggering 25% of the world's prisoners, although we are only 5% of the world's population. The population at home, like the subjugated population abroad, lives under wholesale surveillance. Public services, including public education, infrastructure, and public transportation, become decrepit and dysfunctional. This rulelessness, this enemy, is best seen in the strata of our judiciary. There is an aggressive criminalization of the poor, while the ruling elites have virtual immunity. Protected by high-priced lawyers and non-enforcement or rewriting of laws. amid selective enforcement of laws in the rule-less society. The high rollers on Wall Street and in wealthy enclaves are not prosecuted, for example, for possessing and ingesting illegal drugs, but the poor are thrown into prison and must forfeit all their property for being caught with small amounts of the same drugs. I live in Princeton, New Jersey, and I am sure there are as many drugs and probably of better quality in Princeton than there are in Trenton. But police in Kevlar vests, armed with long-barreled weapons, are not kicking in Princeton doors at 2 in the morning to terrorize families for a nonviolent drug warrant. HSBC, the world's seventh largest bank by total assets, after admitting to laundering $800 million for Central and South American drug cartels, was slapped with symbolic fines and a deferred prosecution agreement, which is the legal equivalent of a get-out-of-jail-free card. The poor, meanwhile, are hounded, arrested, and fined for absurdly criminalized activities such as not mowing their lawns, loitering, selling loose cigarettes, although Eric Garner was not, at the time he was murdered, selling loose cigarettes, carrying open containers of alcohol, or, this is my favorite, and it's real, obstructing pedestrian traffic, which means standing on a sidewalk. These fines are used to fill state and county budget shortfalls resulting from corporations and the wealthy fixing the rules to avoid paying meaningful taxes, if they pay taxes at all.
And here we must pause part one of Chris Hedges' talk, America, the Farewell Tour. We'll hear the rest next week. The audio comes from a video posted online by Joe Friendly. The audio was re-engineered by Wilton Vaught, host of the podcast Other Voices, Other Choices. Thanks once again to Wilton. You can find more of Wilton's work on his YouTube channel and also at his website, othervoicesotherchoices.blogspot.com. You will recognize that address as just around the corner from our own website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. If you would like to rehear any installment of our show, you can find a copy at our website. Once again, that's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, that's me, myself, and our makeup consultant, Governor Ralph Northam. On behalf of the entire staff, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.